When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lotte Hulst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. I want to thank you so much for making your way here, checking out this podcast. If it's your first time, or maybe you've been here a few times, but haven't hit that subscribe button yet, I do hope you'll be inspired to do so at least now or before the end of the interview. Of course, you can find us at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you like to get your favorite podcast from. We'll give you three brand new interviews a week, one Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, an excellent way to keep up with all of your favorite artists, discover some new ones, know what's happening in the music world. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today I'm going to be talking with Bob Mould. He's got a brand new record called Blue Hearts. So this interview was first recorded video form Instagram Live for Consequence of Sound's Instagram Live series, the Kyle Meredith Live series. And we got on to talk about, at that point, he had just released the first single to the new record. It's called American Crisis. And I wanted to hear about him writing that in 2018 and how it's all escalated, what he was writing about, how it's all escalated since then. We talk about Minneapolis. That's where Husker Du came out of, seeing that town during the George Floyd era. And as he talks about the diversity of the Minneapolis scene as Husker Du was coming up. And in fact, we do a lot of that, comparing the 80s to now, the politics of what was happening during the Reagan era to now in the Trump era. Bob's going to tell you about struggling with his future at that point as a gay man, how that all led to Zen Arcade, the seminal Husker Du record. Of course, we talk about the upcoming election and the importance of Biden winning, the 2020 hurdles in the gay community. As he says, the attention really needs to be put on helping trans people. He'll also tell us about the second single on Blue Hearts called Forecast of Rain that touches on his religious upbringing in the Catholic Church, how he even went back later in life, still searching, but of course not finding what he was hoping. It's all of that and more discussing the record Blue Hearts, Kyle Meredith with Bob Mould.
Thanks, Kyle. It's good to be here.
Now, Bob, as I understand, this is not a new song that you have written. I mean, obviously it's a new song release, but it wasn't written specifically for this exact moment that we're in, right?
No, American Crisis was written in the group of songs that became Sunshine Rock. So I think the last time I checked my notes, it was April of 2018 that I wrote American Crisis. And going back to my calendar, I would have been in Berlin, so I think that's where that all came together. Yeah, we brought I brought the song to the band in May of 2018, May of 2018, when we recorded Sunshine Rock. And so the idea with that album was to be a happy record, a little more optimistic after two darker records. And American Crisis was a little edgy for that record, so I shelved that and then picked up the Shocking Blue cover of Send Me a Postcard. They're pretty much the same key and the same tempo. And it's funny because Send Me a Postcard was the, I think that was the only like first take on the floor vocal that I had done on basic tracks. So anyways, carrying forward to now, yeah, it's a 2-year-old song. And just when I thought things were bad 2 years ago, here we are.
That's sort of been the thing about everything, is every single point we've said, well, it can't get any worse, you know, as if we hadn't watched enough movies in our lifetime to know to never, ever say that. That's sort of what we're being faced with every day. I do find it interesting, and you and I got to talk a lot about Sunshine Rock, the material that you were writing from Germany, looking at the U.S., and especially as you were coming back to the U.S., this definitely seems like, you know, even coming from your punk rock past, this seems like maybe one of the angriest, loudest, heaviest songs that I think you've ever written, at least in recent times. Because again, how we can hear this song right now, looking at the Trump administration, looking at what especially the GOP side of Congress are trying to push, just looking what you mentioned evangelicals in the lyrics and everything, you know, how that's sized up and everything. What's changed, especially in that song, from how you wrote it to where it's landing right now that you can see?
Well, I mean, a lot of things have happened this year in 2020. A lot of things have happened in the last few months. I mean, you know, in Louisville with Breonna Taylor, Minneapolis, George Floyd, many, many things like that, many tragedies like that over the past year have been brought to light. Many tragedies like that over the last 400 years have happened on our soil. A couple of years ago, it just seemed like, oh, you know, it's, things are really bad. You know, it's this, you know, sort of, you know, charismatic, say anything television guy, you know, who somehow snuck into the White House, not winning the popular vote, but winning the Electoral College, and, you know, sort of enacting all of these, you know, regressive ideas, you know, taking us back to the 50s, I guess the 1850s. And, you know, now there's a, you know, there's really no glass left to break. I think most of the emergencies are clearly in front of us now. You know, writing from Germany, you know, I think all countries in the world, I think, you know, there's, you know, populism has been on the rise for a while. You know, in the Netherlands with Geert Wilders, and France with Marine Le Pen. You know, you've got Orban, you've got Duda in Poland, you've got Bolsonaro. I mean, you've got, you know, I mean, the cast of characters is great. You know, Johnson, you've got all these characters. You know, it's just, it's really frightening how quickly these things can turn. And, you know, the song like American Crisis, those words fell out of my head in probably the amount of time it takes me to sing them. And, yeah, I haven't written a song that pointed in years, but then again, things maybe haven't been that terribly bad in years and decades, maybe. And now the confluence of, you know, just, I mean, with coronavirus and, you know, the elections hopefully coming up, we've got a lot of, you know, we've got a lot of things on our plate, a lot of trouble right now in the country. So the whatever urgency the song had 2 years ago has only been amplified 100-fold in the last few months.
And of course, for those who don't know, you know, when you go back to your early days, speaking of Husker Du, I mean, you guys were a Minneapolis band. You brought up Minneapolis with George Floyd there. And again, you know, you're not in Minneapolis right now. I believe you're in San Francisco, right?
San Francisco, yeah.
Have you been in contact with people over there? I mean, what has that, you know, I know this is a bit of an obvious question. What has that been like, you know, as you're seeing that as your hometown?
It was tough. I mean, under any circumstances, terrible to see such a tragedy. To see Minneapolis in such unrest, and to, you know, just have memories of going there in 1978 to be, you know, a kid who grew up in a, I grew up in a farm town in upstate New York, you know, 5,000 people, no people of color. I get an underprivileged scholarship to go to McAllister College, and I get there in September of 78, and I, on my dorm floor alone, it's, you know, people of all religions and, you know, ethnicities and beliefs and histories. And I had a lot of catching up to do really quick. In 1979, I was lucky enough to get a band going. The band was called Husker Du. And, you know, over the next decade, you know, that band, along with a lot of bands like The Replacements or Soul Asylum or Prince or, you know, Terry and Jimmy or, you know, all the, you know, this just wide variety of musicians and artists in the Twin Cities, you know, we all congregated on a venue called First Avenue, and everybody shared the stage and everybody played equally. And, you know, I remember the Hmong resettlement in the late 70s, you know, the Somali resettlements later on. I mean, you know, Minnesota's been, you know, working on diversity for decades, and then to see something like this happen, and I haven't been living there for a long time, I had to dig back into the information, you know, looking at the police unions, which I think we're all finding out as, you know, sort of a, you know, that's a really big problem right now, you know, strong force police unions, excessive force on the street, you know, connections to Trump, you know, just the general police state, the prison industrial complex. I know there's a lot of big topics to throw out at once. I guess I just felt terrible for the tragedy, and I felt really bad for Minnesota. I used to live a couple blocks from that precinct that burned, and, you know, watching footage, you know, and seeing things go by, oh, there's the old Husker Du studio, oh, there's Glam Doll Donuts, there's my friend's record store, you know, it's just sort of, I haven't had a jolt like that since 9/11, I guess, when I lived real close to the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan. So it's just, you know, just personally, that's how it was hitting me. I mean, if it took, you know, and, you know, I think in the, you know, in the wake of that, you know, again, all of us refocusing on Black Lives Matter, all of, you know, and now defund police, and, you know, a lot of different social ideas that I think we need to address. You know, I mean, again, speaking on McAllister, one of the, you know, I was just really grateful to get that scholarship, and then ending up, you know, doing a lot of work in sociology and political science and economics and trying to build an urban studies major for myself before those kinds of things were standard jobs, I guess. So, I mean, I think I understand cities. I think I understand dynamics of cities. It's something that I, you know, again, had formal education in. You know, now I'm seeing a lot of things, you know, these ideas of gentrification, you know, and I think, you know, I think in Louisville, you know, right now it's, you know, again, I think as we're looking for, you know, as we're looking beyond redlining and gerrymandering and, you know, excessive police force, now we've come to gentrification. And, you know, these are all, you know, really big topics I think we need to, you know, we need to think about. And, you know, little old man, a little old 2-minute punk rock song, I barely scratched the surface.
Yeah, but it is interesting how it unfolds across the whole record. And I'll point out for anybody who hasn't followed the news, and of course I'm based here in Louisville, it was Sunday night, it came out that that a gentrification project was possibly the thing that led to the death of Breonna Taylor, which has been sort of the eye-opening thing lately, the eye-opening thing today, you know, it's to add along with all the rest.
Yeah.
you've said a little bit about this record with Blue Hearts, and we're not just talking about American Crisis, but American Crisis definitely paints it that you are talking about the parallels a lot of times between, I think the years you said anyway, was 1984 and 2020. I think what we're basically talking about here is the Reagan years and the Trump years. That's super interesting because on one side of the pop culture happenings, when we talk about what's happening out in the streets, people taking to the streets, of course, we're referencing the 60s a lot of times. What you're getting out of here is a bit more focused, I guess, on the political side of things. Again, as we talk about Reagan, let's start this. What was obvious to you about what was happening to both times as you were coming up in the 80s?
I went to school with young Republicans. I remember them on campus with their briefcases, and they were all, you know, very, very well to do. And they were talking about Ronald Reagan and we're going to change the world. And sure enough, Reagan won. And, you know, onward we went. I remember coming to San Francisco in the summer of 81. I was 20 years old. Husker Du was touring. Well, we called it touring. I mean, we were pretty much homeless and in a van. And if we could get a phone number for a place to stay, we'd go to that town and hang out and maybe get a show or three or four, you know, if we were lucky. And, you know, I remember, you know, being not a closeted young gay man, but, you know, sort of self-hating, not fully understanding my sexuality and my being and my work and, you know, where all those things intersect. Completely at peace with it now, but at 20, not being real certain of what my future was. And I remember being here when, you know, they made the discoveries with, you know, Kaposi sarcoma and, you know, PCP and gay men dying at an alarming rate in major cities, San Francisco and New York. And this thing called GRID that eventually got called AIDS. And, you know, over the course of time, you know, the Reagan administration just turned a blind eye to it. It was never mentioned. It was made fun of it. You know, press conferences. I think it was, you know, just, I've seen a lot of footage from back then as if I don't remember it, but to, you know, refresh myself, I, you know, watch people talking. And, it took our first, you know, sort of television movie star personality backed by evangelicals type president to, you know, what did it take him till 1985 to actually say the words, you know, after he'd lost friends, you know, people that were close to him. And, you know, that parallel with where we are now, you know, again, we're at the end of a first term of a television president who's got a lot of backing from the evangelicals. And it's sort of the sons of the fathers, I guess we could say, the Grahams and the Falwells. And it's the same, you know, a lot of the same cast of characters. You know, maybe we don't have as many hysterical, you know, made up crying women singing torch songs, you know, and stuff like that. But it's still, it's that very repressive agenda, you know, I guess now we call it a culture war. Back then I was just like, what the fuck are these people? Why are they doing this to me? What did I do? I'm just trying to live my life. Yeah, I mean, so you can see the parallels. And I guess as I started writing music for Blue Hearts, you know, in the fall of last year, I was in Berlin playing a lot of guitar. I came back to San Francisco in late November. And then, you know, America is just, we're constantly, you know, it's a constant barrage of information, televisions, media, everything all the time. And, you know, in Berlin, I was aware of what was happening, but when you're back in it and living in it, it resonates, you know, a lot heavier. And a lot of the words for this record came out, and I was putting myself sort of back in the place that I was at the end of 1983, you know, thinking about being in a band, being on tour, not really having a place to live, you know, dependent on the kindness of others. Making these records and just touring and going door to door and trying to tell these stories. And I remember the lead up to Zen Arcade having all this very angry music and being really confused about my sexuality and just writing all these words in the back of a van over, you know, a weekend, sharing it with the other guys and starting to make this concept record. And, you know, anyways, you get the idea. It's just everything felt, when I looked back, I was like, my God, that's who I was, and it feels the same now. And what was my skill set then? What were the tools that I had to work with then? You know, and I had a voice and a guitar and an amp and not much else. So I set out to not emulate, but just to recall that kind of feeling, you know, to sort of put 1984 and 2020 next to each other and just say, wow, it's really starting to line up. And I guess the sad conclusion in a sense to this long-winded explanation is that, you know, now we have a pandemic. we have Tony Fauci on television again. And I'm just like, you can't, you know, not to diminish anything. This is just me personally going, you can't make this stuff up. You just cannot make this stuff up. And now 6 months into absolute and complete chaos and total inefficiency and inaction by this government, I'm clearly not at a loss for words, but I'm just like at a completely lost faith in this, you know, I never had any faith in these people that are running the country now. And I have none at all now.
So as you look to November, do you have, I mean, we're talking obviously Trump versus Biden, but I think a lot of people are really curious about, you know, that VP pick, because as Biden said, he might be the one term president. So maybe who we're really voting for here is the vice president. Do you have the person that that you would prefer to see in there?
I think this is you vote for America or you vote for Trump. I mean, Joe Biden clearly has all the experience in the world. He's been a world leader. He's been an emissary for this country most of his life. I think he knows most of the leaders of the world. If anybody can try to go to the rest of the civilized world and ask forgiveness and try to rebuild things in a better way in terms of America and the rest of the world, you know, I think Joe Biden is really good. I think the fact that he is committed to having a woman as vice president is a smart move. People are talking about women of color. I mean, obviously have a lot of experience here with Kamala Harris, you know, Stacey Abrams. I mean, there's you know, many great people. I was very excited about Pete Buttigieg, you know, being a gay man, just seeing somebody at his age with military experience and just such a good thinker, a good person. You know, I think Bernie Sanders has got a lot of good qualities. Elizabeth Warren. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good people on representing the Democrats now. And I think it's really up to Biden to sort of, maybe one thing that I'd like to see is for him, once he's made his vice presidential choice, is to then start letting us know who will be taking all of these key positions. Because one of the things that we learned, you know, when you just say drain the swamp and destroy politics, you create a vacuum that can easily be filled by your billionaire friends that really don't know anything about politics and not much about life and really nothing about the real world. So for me, it would be nice if Biden would identify the key figures in the administration before we get to November, because then we can have a true compare and contrast.
No, I agree. I've said before that the smartest thing anybody on that debate stage, when we still had, you know, a handful of them, to say was that if I win, this is my cabinet, you know, because I thought it was a great lineup. And I'm glad you brought up Pete, because, you know, I'll tie that back around to what we were saying in those comparisons between the early 80s and 2020, because, you know, for Pete to be a gay man and that only to be a blip of the conversation, I mean, that feels like one of the biggest differences. From your point of view, you know, it's much, much less taboo, if it's taboo at all, to be gay anymore in popular culture, which, you know, obviously I'm saying this as a straight man, seems like a humongous accomplishment. Like, you know, at least some version of the dream must have been realized. What are the hurdles then? What are the hurdles in the gay community at this point, as we just come out of Pride Month, which is still a very, very important conversation?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really, right now the key issue is the trans community, you know, and trans people of color. I mean, you know, historically, you know, trans people of color were, you know, there for the LGBTQ community at the very beginning, you know, the Comptons or Stonewall or any of the major turning points in American gay culture. You know, my experience as a gay man, you know, being marginalized, being told I'm less than, you know, that's my personal story. I cannot apply that story to others. But as we all move forward with our grievances, which are the grievances of the American people and not of the leader of the American people, we will find intersections and we will find commonality. And that's where we, you know, hopefully as, you know, as a democracy, as America, we identify those intersections and we move forward with those in mind. That's, I think that's the goal right now. You know, specifically for the gay community, I mean, the Supreme Court ruling, you know, giving equal rights was great. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a big move. You know, I've had these conversations with people before. I remember having a long sort of a by-mail correspondence with Margaret Cho, and it was right around the time that a lot of gay progress had been made, and she was very celebratory, and I just said, Margaret, not to be a downer, but this whole thing is always a pendulum. It goes back and forth, and no change is perfect, no change is permanent, no victory is guaranteed forever, and you know, forces will come and try to undo all the progress that's been made, you know, whether it was during the second Obama administration or before that. You know, I used to do a lot of work with Servicemen's Legal Defense Network, you know, around ENDA, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, stuff like that. You know, I did a lot of work with Evan Wolfson with Freedom to Marry. So, I mean, I've been fairly engaged, but right now the you know, I think it's gay youth at risk. I think it's trans people of color. I mean, my God, what was there? Has there been like 6 or 7, you know, trans murders in the last month, you know, during Pride month? It's, I mean, that's where the focus needs to go. I mean, my, you know, I'm an old white gay guy, you know, I'm represented, you know, I'm Modern Family will be in syndication forever. It's, you know, I don't know. Is it too soon to have any kind of humor? I feel so bad even making jokes about anything. But yeah, it's, I think, you know, for me, I felt like a lot of progress has been made. I worry about kids. I worry about people of color. I really worry about the trans community. And that's where we need to put our energy as we move forward.
I'm at least very hopeful that, you know, because for all of my disdain for the social media world, it seems like it is pushing the conversations a lot faster than they used to go. And I do see that out there. The fact that this is in the conversation, and it is a big part of the conversation right now, you know, in what seems like, you know, I'm learning new terms every day. I'm, you know, my lexicon is expanding every single day at a rate that I've never at least been aware of, at least. And I think that's, even at the tiniest, you know, magnification, a very promising thing.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. Again, being older than the people who are about to affect the change that we need. You know, again, it's always a battle to keep up with terminology and to keep up with how people self-identify. And you know, at my age, I'm always afraid I'm going to slip up and say the wrong thing. So forgive me if I do. But I'm trying to learn and listen, you know, as you are. And you know, again, with the LGBTQ community, with Black Lives Matter, I mean, there's, you know, the language and the discourse, it's, you know, again, because of social media, it's instant. You know, what was an acceptable term last week is now we don't say that anymore. And it's like, whoa, okay, I'm trying to keep up. I think I'm a good person. I'm trying to do the right thing.
You know? I think that's the important thing right there. Yeah, it's knowing some. I don't know who said this, and probably plenty of people have said this. It's knowing that you're occasionally going to say the wrong thing and being very okay and upfront with rolling with the change immediately. And I think, yeah, you know, we cannot be afraid of that. We have to be ready for that, you know, that's going to happen. This all, I guess, expands more on the record, Blue Hearts. I mean, this seems to be the running theme of the rest of the record. Is that what we can expect?
Generally speaking, the record starts pretty hot with politics. I mean, I come right out of the gate. It's a start with a, you know, sort of downbeat acoustic song that, you know, lays out some of the issues. And then, you know, the next couple songs are very fiery. There's a song called Forecast of Rain that's, you know, going to be an important track. It really gets deep into me and religion, you know, and you know, I'll sort of preempt the conversation that I know will come when people hear the song a little bit. You know, I went to church every Sunday. You know, I went to Catholic school once a week. I was confirmed, and you know, that's where I left Catholicism for the time, you know, in my 40s in the aughts when I was living in Washington, D.C., I went back to the Catholic Church for 3 years and tried to find the message. I tried to find a place, and unfortunately, I could not find a place for myself. I can't say I'm an expert on religion. I can't quote scripture, but then again, lots of people can't. I understand religion has a place, and it has an important place for a lot of people. It's about community, and it's just about gathering and trying to build a better world and trying to live sort of in the norms of society. Not all of those norms work for me. Many of them do, and I carry that with me every day. I think we all do as sort of upright citizens. I do have problems when, again, the Grahams and the Falwells and the evangelicals, by and large, have no problem throwing unconditional support behind Trump, who is a racist and a liar. And I could keep checking the list off, but that is not the way I learned religion. And that does not look like the religion that I have an appreciation for. So having said that, yeah, that song is the Forecast of Rain is going to be a real fiery song. There's another song called Password to My Soul, which is sort of the wrap up of the record, and then there's an epilogue song that follows that. But, again, most of the record is very political. There's a lot of sort of strong takes on social media, and privacy and being tracked. I try to do it in tongue-in-cheek ways. There's a few bad relationship songs, but I think all in all, it's pretty much a protest record. In the sense that I learned what protest records were in the '60s. So as a kid, so.
An album for our times. As a former altar boy, I can appreciate where you're coming from on all of that as well. When I left at 13, Bob Mould, thank you so much for joining me again on this edition of Kyle Meredith Live. I want to point out again, Blue Hearts comes out September 25th. I got that date right.
Yep.
That'll be out here. I'm looking so forward to this record. I love what you do, so thank you for continuing to do that and being a voice in these times as well.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks for giving me the platform. And, for anybody else in my position, if you have a voice, this would be a good time to use it.
Absolutely. All right. Remember, the series runs every Tuesday and Thursday at 3 p.m. right here on the Consequence of Sound Instagram. You can also find me 6 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday at WFPK.org. Thank you all so much for watching and joining us. And Bob, thank you so much again.
Thanks, Kyle. Bye-bye.
Bob Mould talking about the record Blue Hearts. Again, you can find the video version of that on the Consequence of Sound Instagram as well as on YouTube just by searching Kyle Meredith With. Now, it was just back in 2018 on Bob's last album, Sunshine Rock, that we caught up in a very different conversation. That album, with its positive outlook and sound, we got to talk about him living in Berlin and how that has affected his life at that point. Of course, plenty more politics and the upcoming 40th anniversary plans for Husker Du, part two of Kyle Meredith with Bob Mould.
How you doing?
I'm enjoying the hell out of Sunshine Rock anyway. I heard you in the past say you tend to make either a light record or a dark record, and I guess this is the light record, right?
Yeah, I think so. With the last couple of records being a little heavier than normal in tone, I've tried to stay focused on the brightness, on the sunshine this time. And I know it might seem a little contrary given the state of the world these days, but really try to make a point to try to add more melody, add a little bit of optimism, as much optimism as I'm allowed to add to my records. I'm real happy with the way this one turned out. I think it's a cool record. It's a bright record. The album packaging is fairly bright, and it's a nice change.
Well, you've got Sunshine Rock, Sunny Love Song, Camp Sunshine, just three songs titles right there that kind of
and Western Sunset, the closer.
That's right. Well, you kind of said that despite what's happening in the world today, and I wondered that, like, do you make the decision to make sort of, I'm going to say, a happy album? Is that regardless of what your actual feelings or the honest reflection of whatever might be going in your life may be?
Well, you know, as I alluded to with the last two records, with Beauty and Ruin and Patch the Sky, both being, you know, a little more somber than normal, you know, that was, you know, due to, you know, losing both parents in succession. And, you know, as we all get older, we experience a lot of loss. And Lord knows there's been more since then. But, you know, for me, it was a very conscious effort. It was almost as if I was putting post-it notes around the house, around the apartment, saying, try to think a little brighter. Don't let everything overwhelm you all the time. And yeah, I mean, with the, you know, the political climate can be very overwhelming. I find personally the days that I don't wake up and go right to the news are usually my best days. You know, it's the days where I wake up and I read a book about, you know, The Making of Blue by Joni Mitchell, or, you know, I read a Beatles, you know, anthology book, or, you know, to try to stay away from that stuff that really takes us down, especially at the beginning of a day. So, yeah, it's just little things like that, little life maneuvers that, you know, they come to me, I guess. So that's, yeah, so it's sort of writing forcefully with towards the optimism. And it's not to say that there are not dark moments on the record. There certainly are, but trying to illuminate things more.
Well, I mean, I'll bring up the song I Fought. I mean, there's still some, there's a raging fire, it sounds like, going on that song, especially.
Yeah, that was a pretty much a live one take vocal on the floor. There wasn't a lot of looking back after that vocal. You know, I think I tried it four times, and I was like, oh, that's good. We have four to work with. You want the barbed wire? You want the broken glass? You want the set on fire? You want the thrown out of an airplane?
That's your choices. That's your choices.
Those are the choices. So, and there's no comping. So if we pick your poison. But right. Yeah. There's, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of stuff going on.
This might work in that as well, because you know, I'm calling you. You're in Berlin right now, and this is where you've been living for the past couple of years, right?
Yeah, I've been bouncing back and forth between San Francisco and Berlin, but mostly Berlin. I'm just wrapping up the first 2 years on my residence permit, and hopefully we'll get to stay. Might not be able to. Still working on that with the government, but you know, it's been a great experience. It's a city that, you know, I remember before the wall came down, and you know, certainly after. I have a lot of friends here. It's a really vibrant, amazing city with a lot of history. It's been a real life changer for me, just a real eye opener. You know, again, in these times, and not to get too political, but you know, for a couple of years now, it's just been really tough and really sad to watch, you know, our government beating up on, you know, America's closest friends. Mm-hmm. It's just really strange. And, beating up a country, you know, and, you know, sort of pointing at them, you know, he's socialist, you know, and this, you know, these whole ideas, these exaggerated notions that, you know, socialism is evil and will end up like Venezuela. It's like, well, you know, I live in a social capitalist country, and, you know, things work pretty well over here. It's just been really educational. And, you know, I know a lot of people are fortunate when they're in university or college, they get to do their year abroad. And for me, this has been sort of almost 3 years abroad. And you know, it's just been, you know, a real eye opener, you know, really, you know, it's a lot of, I've got a lot of great friends here. It's a lot of great art and culture and music. And, you know, I also love San Francisco. You know, it's not to, you know, not to say that America doesn't have wonderful, great things, but yeah, I just wish people would stop spreading lies about other countries.
Well, yeah, I mean, when we've got a fella in charge who's, you know, he's apologizing for all the bad guys suddenly and knocking all the good folks out there. I mean, did you go to Berlin specifically to get away? Like, I know you can never escape what's happening in politics wherever you are in the world, but at least to, you know, for the change of scenery and the people that surround you and everything, is that one of the reasons that took you to Berlin, or were you just looking for a change of scenery anyway?
You know, I'm pretty nomadic by nature. I mean, anybody who's read the book on me, whether it's the autobiography or, you know, whatever, I, you know, tend to move around a lot. You know, it's the beauty of my work and my profession that I can live anywhere. You know, I'd been in San Francisco, I think, about 7 years, and just, I was there for about 6 years, and I'm still there, but, I mean, I've been there full-time for 6 years, and just really wanted to change after, you know, after Patch the Sky at the end of 2016, I knew that I was going to have a couple years of free time, and it was the perfect opportunity to, you know, do something different. So that was the, you know, that was what precipitated the move. You know, I got set up over here right before the election, officially set up here right before the election. So I don't think it was because of the election, but it was weird that it worked out that way.
Yeah.
Because I was convinced that the election was not going to go the direction it did. I was actually in New York City. I had an off night during the election, and it was just, the next morning was just frightening. So right. It's like, all right, back to Berlin.
Well, I mean, it's obviously had a strong impression on you. I think I read even that the artwork even has a hat tip to Germany as well.
Well, a little bit. I mean, the cover has, sort of that, that swirls, yin yang, whatever people like to call that. I remember as a kid seeing, a couple different record labels that use those designs. So there's a tip to that, pulling the colors, off the flag. Yeah, there's a tip to that. So, yeah, it's got a couple different things going on there. It's pretty iconic and pretty cool. It's a fun cover.
Well, I think the other interesting part about the album that it sounds like you've been excited about, too, is you're working with an orchestra this time around, which I don't think we've heard you do like this before.
I've always, again, going back to, being a small child in the 60s and, listening to all those great, great pop songs that had those, lush strings, whether it was, all the Al DeLore strings on Glenn Campbell stuff, whether it's the things that Spector was doing, obviously George Martin for the Beatles. As a kid, those left such a deep impression on me. In 1989, when I put out Workbook, my first solo record, you was writing cello parts. I had a couple different cello parts on that record, and went back to cello, occasionally over the years. But to build it out to an 18-piece string orchestra was really, really fun. I used the Prague Television Orchestra. They were great to work with. I had a friend in Chicago that helped me with the transcriptions, getting everything in the proper clefs. And then we had another fellow who does a lot of strings for other musicians, took a last look at the charts. And then we sent all the basic tracks to Prague and basically took them a day to get all the strings for five songs laid out. And it was really, really great to... just a really fun experience. And now that I've done it, I fear that I'm like, what will I do without my strings now?
But, it's a bright record, but it is still a heavy record. And to put strings on it, I mean, it works so well because it's all packed in there. It doesn't feel out of place or whatever, these strings. And when you decide that the strings are going to be there, I mean, do you have to alter the way the songs are, or do you find a way to put the strings to the songs in the way they exist already?
A lot of simplistic melody parts were inherent in the writing. When I built them out to be string arrangements, that would be a moment where, okay, guitar solo steps back, drums straighten out, bass takes foundation parts instead of melodic parts. It's just clearing space for the strings, really. Anytime they show up, get rid of one or two other things. But yeah, this, I think all the styles of arrangement, the song Sunshine Rock has the, that classic 60s West Coast pop ascendant string, arrangement at the end. If you look at a song like Lost Faith, it's darker, more of the, more European, Eastern European sort of, melancholic strings. But then when it gets to the chorus, then it's like, that specter kind of, just punching the chord changes home. It's, really, really neat to... Really need to work with all the different, all those different approaches with the strings.
With all that in mind, is that how a cover ended up on the record? Because it's sort of from the era. It's a 60s cover.
Oh, Send Me a Postcard. Yeah, it's a Dutch group called Shocking Blue.
Uh-huh.
I have a feeling more people have heard that song than they know. People are probably like, I don't know that, but you probably do. And it's just one of those songs that I've, heard and loved as a kid, and it stuck with me over the years. And, typically when I'm making an album, I like to have a song that we use as a, sort of a warm-up tool at times, to set levels or do, get vocal mics up and running. So with this album, Send Me a Postcard was that song because, you can sort of mess with things and it's, it's a cover and it's not as valuable as an original or so I think. So it's like, we're not going to burn up any, emotional collateral by doing it. So we did the basic for it, and then I just said, let me take a shot at singing this. And it was the first time that I had sung anything in the studio for this record. And we just put up a vocal mic, and I just lit into it. And again, that was the first take vocal, and I was like, whoa. It's like, that's fun. I don't even really know all these words, but this is great. And you know, Jason and John and my engineer, Bo, you know, they were just in the other room like, you know, holy crap, that was insane. And, you know, then people started coming around the studio over the next couple of days just to hear, you know, management or whoever to hear progress. And it was the only song that had vocals. So that was all we could really play them. So it just became this sort of instant favorite. And as I got to the end of the process of making the album, you know, the 10 and 11 spot on the 12 song album, the, you know, 10 and 11 were always sort of in flux. I had other songs slotted in there, but they were pretty dark and they were pretty heavy. And I think it might have changed the whole tone of the album had I gone with those. So, you know, I quick wrote Camp Sunshine. And, you know, I actually did that on the last day of the sessions and then sent me a postcard. I just looked at it and was like, oh, this is perfect. Let's put that at 11. And it went perfectly into Western Sunset and made for a much more pleasing album close.
Yeah, no, it works.
So it's just, yeah, that's probably too much information for how people make, you know, I make albums the old-fashioned way, right? But, you know, I really consider sequence and, you know, story and how you get to the end, so... Yeah, that's how all that happened.
Yeah, that's what makes it a great album. An album, you know, and I'll emphasize that right there. You know, it's what makes it the fun listen from start instead of just a collection of singles, I guess.
Yeah, thanks for making that distinction. And you know, as sort of a like, you know, longtime artist, I guess, it's been really encouraging the past couple of years for me to see some of the younger artists, you know, like Janelle Monáe, for instance, mm-hmm. who really values the idea of the album as a storytelling device. It's funny because a few years ago, it seemed like it was very far in the other direction, where very much single-driven, song-driven, you know, of-the-moment-driven. And now it feels like people are really trying to create narratives for their albums, and I think it makes the craft stronger all the way around. So I'm happy you mentioned that, and I'm happy to see other people do it, too.
Yeah, well, when you've got a younger generation embracing, as we've heard, you know, for the past decade, embracing vinyl in the way they have, and even as we go more into a streaming society, which... You know, I like all forms. However I can get music, I'll take it. You know, I like to have fun with it all. But mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, I also like to hit play and go on the adventure. You know, I appreciate when an artist kind of puts that in. So, you know, thank you for waving that flag and keeping that flame alive.
Yay. Very cool.
Next year marks 40 years in the business for you. I know you're going to be out there promoting a new record, but does that celebration mean anything? Will there be any, you know, kind of a big to-do with something like that?
Yeah, I know it's coming. I'm always aware of anniversaries. It's sort of crazy and weird. And I think, you know, in light of how busy this decade has been, you know, with the book and the documentary and three albums and, you know, a 33 and a third book about workbook, it's been, you know, just an incredible, you know, sort of an embarrassment of riches. Is that what they say with it?
Right.
Is that an embarrassment of artistic riches, at least for me, to be able to make a lot of work and stay super busy for people. But yeah, there's 40. It's there. We'll come up with something special, I'm sure.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to it. Congratulations again on Sunshine Rock. I've really had a lot of fun listening to it. It's another great one. It really is.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. Thanks for the support. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Bob. Take care.
Bob Mould talking about 2018 Sunshine Rock. I want to include one more interview here that Bob and I did. This one goes back to 2013. In fact, we did this one as a video interview backstage at the Forecastle Festival right here in Louisville, Kentucky. And Bob was in the middle of a pretty cool little, as I said at the time, resurgence. That started with him writing his autobiography. Then he had put together his first power trio since his 90 days. It all resulted in the completely fun album, The Silver Age. And that's what we got to talk about here. So part three of Kyle Meredith with Bob Mould.
It's Kyle Meredith with The Weekly Feed. I'm sitting next to Bob Mould here at Forecastle 2013.
We've
got the river, ducks and everything.
I know. Do you see the sun? There's a sign out of sight that says, no parking on wharf, cars will be launched.
Yeah, we tried to make it pretty for you. It's a nice setup. We built this all set just for you.
Cool.
Hey, thanks for joining us down here. Absolutely. You've got this killer new record called Silver Age.
Yeah.
You got, like, just came in with a lot of fire on this one.
Yeah, a lot of good heat on this.
Yeah, like Bob found some angst again.
Well, Bob got a lot of stuff out of his system and got some unexpected love, I guess.
Yeah.
From the fall of 2008 until the summer of 2011, I was working on my autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
and put that out. So got a lot of stories out there for people to take in. A lot of questions that hadn't been answered. I'm sure there's a lot of new questions I'll have to answer. But it was good to tell. That's usually what happens. What do you mean by that? By that you buried the body?
Well, at least it gives you something new to talk about, though.
Yeah.
You know, it's a different part of the conversation.
Yeah. So that was one thing. And then I hadn't been writing music during that whole 3 years. Yeah. So 2012 was coming. I knew that the Sugar Copper Blue 20th anniversary stuff was coming. And, alongside all that, I was doing a lot of stuff with the Foo Fighters. Dave Grohl had asked me to work on their most recent record. Went out and played some shows with them. So, it was a combination of things. Hanging out with a rock band.
Kind of puts it in you.
Seeing the Sugar thing coming. A lot of love. Wrote a record real quick. It's called Silver Age. Came out last September, and here we are. Going to be playing a lot of it tonight.
That's the thing about it. I guess when I hear the record, the first thing I think, and this isn't one of those like, oh, you're in your upper years of rock or everything, but it seems like, generically, you get an artist who starts at a certain point, and as the years go by, it becomes less and less angsty, but, found a way to connect with that or something.
Yeah, I appreciate angsty is good. I wasn't thinking angsty when I wrote it. I was just sort of throwing shit around. And that maybe it landed there. Like I said, I think I was feeling particularly lovely on this record.
You get to do that.
This is what my love sounds like, folks. You ought to see my hate.
Well, see, you could have written any kind of record, though, I guess, at this point, because you've done so many different styles.
Well, I did a couple dad records already, so it's cool.
Dad records. You kind of came out of the box on a solo record a bit more dad than
you
than
get,
this one.
You get, yeah. it. It happens, right before...
Go backwards.
Right before I sat down to work on the book, the record that I had put out in Life called Life and Times was very, down and more introspective. Yeah. This one was just, sort of piss and vinegar. And, and also, Jason and John, my rhythm section, we've been playing together for 5 years now, and we have a sound, and it's easier for me to envision what songs will sound like with those guys. So, sort of writing to the strong suit as well.
Well, when you're writing like this, and, we'll call them pop songs, because in rock and roll, you kind of have a few different things, so it's pop song. How hard is it just to write a pop song these days? And I guess what I'm referencing is the lead singer at XTC recently, somebody asked him, he's like, why aren't you doing it? He's like, it's so much harder, I just can't pump pop songs anymore. Just can't pump them out, but you seem to have no problem just saying, oh, this is totally going to work, and it's going to sound great, and people are going to love this.
Well, Andy's a great writer. I can't speak for his system, but, my own system... a record like Silver Age, I could sit down and pretend to write a pretend record like that, but fortunately when I sat down to write this one, I really was feeling it, and I think that's what comes through. I think sometimes people write records, they go, oh, maybe I should write this kind of record now, and it sounds like they aren't really meaning it. It happens, especially if you're fortunate enough like Andy or myself to write for decades. Sometimes you write one and you're like, I thought that's what I wanted to do, but it really wasn't quite there. So
maybe waiting it out even plays a part in it, like if you can take your time.
It's good serendipity, good timing, all that stuff. It's a black science. Yeah. You hope for the best. Some of the songs, it took exactly as long as it took you to hear them for me to write them. Some of them take weeks. Some take months. You sit there looking for that last line or the first line, and then,
I think that's been
stuff.
A question of how some artists can have this really productive part of their career and never be able to make that connection again, and then some artists, Joe Strummer was a great example of that, like never lost that connection, was able to kind of keep going the entire time. Why does that work for some people?
Joe's in a special league, but you never know. It's life, it's the people that are around you,
right?
It's the places that you spend your life, and all that. It's pretty mysterious. Just good to have your eyes open. That's the main thing.
Well, you mentioned your book and everything, the autobiography. Mm-hmm. I know there's some artists that kind of have a problem with looking back. They never want to do that, but you kind of went there. You said, I am going to do it. I'm going to get into it, and this is the whole past.
Yeah, well, I had a standing offer from Little Brown, the publisher. They had reached out to me in 2001, and at that time I was 40 years old, and I hadn't really, I was just like, write my autobiography now. Waited until 2008 when it seemed like the time was right. There was stories to tell. I appreciate people who don't want to look back. You know, having done it, I'm happy not to look back anymore. And it's given me a lot of energy to look forward. But yeah, I totally hear that. You know, I thought about that a lot when I went into it. So.
And I guess that's a problem though, when you have that long of a career, when you're part of two famous bands, you know? And so it's like you're always connected. You're always riding that train. That was a Richie Havens quote about Woodstock. Yeah. He's always going to ride that train.
Yep.
Does that become a problem? Because, you know, Silver Age is a great record that can stand on its own, but when the reviews come out, you're definitely going to hear something about Cop Blue.
You're going to hear something about Zanarchy Age. You're going to hear something
about that.
It's a high-end problem.
Well, sure it is a high-end problem. But, you know, is there any part where that just became, you've got to be so defiant over that to say, listen, this is this record, it's not that.
I used to be. I couldn't give a rat's ass anymore.
Not anymore.
It's either people like it or they don't. Yeah. I like it. It's cool by me. Yeah, I've let go of that. Like I said, jokingly, but seriously, it's a great problem to have.
Yeah, sure.
Great problem to have.
And what about the unflattering parts of the book? Because you kind of gave it your all.
It's a lot of them.
Yeah. That's another thing, you know, artists who write their books, they're going to tell the exciting stories and the salacious stories. But to kind of give your entire self over to the art to say, no, this is the whole story.
Well, what I was trying to do with the book, and I think I did it judging by the reactions of some people, is I tried as best I could to show people how I was in the moment. Because there's moments where in the book I look at it and I'm just like, what a asshole. You know, I mean, really, and those, and truly, those were the moments where my mind wasn't always right.
Yeah.
You know, there's times in 93 when I was a little out of my head. There was times in 83, 4, 5 when I was pretty dour.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I think, the right word for that. So, yeah, I mean, I think the book shows it really well. I mean, there was moments in 04, 05 where I felt real vulnerable and stupid. There it is.
So, do you think it adds to the mythology or takes away? I mean, I'm talking about the mythology of rock and roll as the rock star, you know, as that goes.
This is what we do with our lives.
Sure.
I love reading that mythology in other people's books.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have a lot of it in mine because it really wasn't there. I'm pretty much a meat and potatoes guy, so it's not.
But I always kind of wonder about that, because when you're writing the autobiography, sure, you're taking care of a lot of the hardcore fans and everything, but are you also looking at, like, yeah, I've got a legacy at some point, you know?
Well, you want to. I think the biggest thing with writing a book is to not tell stories about other people that you wouldn't want told about yourself.
Yeah.
I think it's just as a courtesy. I think that, you know, you don't try to tell other people's stories. You just try to show people your story, and that's what that's what they get.
This might keep you entirely away from this question at all, that what you just said, mm-hmm. but, you know, after all the years, after Husker Du and everything else that came afterwards, and all of these artists who say, yeah, Bob Mould was a huge influence on me, you ever just look down at one point and go, seriously? Fuck.
No, I think
did I make that?
I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think it's really great. It's because I feel that way about other people. You know, I have, you know, where the Townsend, Richard Thompson, the Ramones, I mean, all the, you know, music is a really strong, it's a strong art form. It takes in so many emotions and so many ideas. To have other people say that I influence their work or influence the way that they look at life, and that's sort of a weird responsibility if I want it to be, but I look at it as like, that's really great. It's really, really great.
Continuing good lineage and good music.
Yeah. It's hot potato.
Sure.
Like I said in the book, you know, you get an idea, you hold on to it, and you throw it, somebody else catches it. So it's cool.
Well, Bob, it's been a pleasure talking. Silver Age, fantastic. We'll look forward to the next one.
Again, that interview back 2013, Bob Mould talking about the Silver Age. The brand new album is called Blue Hearts, due out this September. Do check it out. And again, you can find all these interviews, the video versions, at YouTube. Just type in Kyle Meredith With. And while you're at it, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening from right now. Again, podcast form, Spotify, Apple Podcast, iTunes, of course, YouTube, anywhere you get your favorite podcast from, just type in Kyle Meredith With. Brand new interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. After that, head to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. It's an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, WFPK.org, 6 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday. Consequence of Sound, they've got your music and film news. You can also find me on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Kyle Meredith on all three of those. Hope to see you over there as well. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.